Today is September the 6th, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, and we are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the Internet at 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, and on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, and the program is live streamed on the Internet at WBAI.org at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM, WBAI.org, and our website is PCRadioshow.org. When WBAI is in a membership drive, a replacement program may be scheduled, but the regular program of the Personal Computer Show will continue to be available each week on PRN.FM. And tonight, we have a number of interesting news items that will provoke thinking on your part. Let me cover the first one. Time Warner Cable is now Charter or Spectrum. They were taken over recently, and they had an app that was available that many people were using. It was called My TWC, and basically it's something, if you want to know more about the it's like a TV guide and more information about Time Warner, and the name continues to be My TYC. And what happened was that it was brought to the attention of everyone that 4 million user records were unsecured. Now, exactly was there any violation in terms of any mischief that was that abused the information on it? I don't know. If you happen to be a Time Warner user, or now it's called Comcast or Spectrum, you should contact Time Warner and ask them, I'm sorry, let me not say Time Warner, let's say Charter, okay, and say, what's up, what can I do, and what should I do? But let me go, you know, one of the things is that it's a form of cloud computing. What it is that the information was put up in the cloud, and you could say, well, what did Time Warner do that was wrong? They really didn't do anything wrong. What they did was they contracted a company to write the application. It was BroadSoft. BroadSoft developed the application, and what they did was they put it on an Amazon server, and they just found out that the information that was of 4 million people who want to know more about the Spectrum schedule now, all that personal information was out in the open. They've since closed it up. Now, this brings up an interesting point. This is called, who's at fault there? Is it Time Warner? Well, a lot of things are outsourced, and you don't necessarily say, okay, step by step, tell me what did you do and to ensure that I am secure. Because if you do that, you might as well do the job yourself. So this is an example of cloud computing where that's where my discomfort is. Is it something you can get rid of? No. It's with us. We have to learn how to live with it. But when it's outsourced, how do you control it? In fact, I would suspect that many people who had been using this application, My TWC, didn't even know that it was sitting on an Amazon server. And many of people didn't even know that it was not developed by Time Warner. It was contracted to BroadSoft. So that's something that we really have to consider. Another item that we talked about last week was Kaspersky. You know, the FBI, the government, are saying that we should avoid all use of Kaspersky products. And right now, there's the Senate is thinking of passing a bill saying the government should remove all Kaspersky products. Well, did they do anything wrong? No. I think the only thing wrong is that it's by association that it's a Russian company, but that doesn't mean that you're doing something mischievous or that you are doing something that illegal at all. Now, okay, you say, all right, so we don't do business with them, but did you know that a lot of their software is embedded in other products? It's embedded in communication equipment like Juniper. It's embedded in the Microsoft operating system, at least the code is. Well, I could see where Microsoft can easily or more readily change the code, replace it. But what do you do with equipment that you bought? And, are you going to just say, okay, Let's say I have a Juniper router. I'm going to now go buy a new router. That's not really practical at all. So I don't know how it's going to be resolved. It's a very interesting question. That's, you know, that's really something. There was a tech item that came out that I was very interested in, and that's SanDisk. SanDisk is owned by Western Digital, and one of the issues that I always have with the USB flash drives is that you have no idea what the speeds are, but I would always say that on SD card memory or micro SD card memory, you had a little number on it. It's like 1, 2, 3, all the way up to 10. And essentially what it says is that it is the minimum of write speed. So if it says 10 on it, the minimum write speed on it is 10 megabits per second. However, when this standard was developed many years ago, that was considered fast. Today, no, that's very slow. I think we're so like a magnitude, and it's like, you know, it's much faster than that now that's available. But so when you buy a micro SD card, if it's less than 10, it will be, you know, you'll have a smaller number. But if it's greater than 10, it'll just give you a 10. You have no idea how much faster it is. There is a program that I do use, and it's called Speed Out 0.5. If you can download, it's a free program, and you can run it, and it tells you what the read speed is and the write speed is. And I use that program to test out the different flash drives I have, so that I could then use them in different manners. Like, for instance, I have USB flash drives which are very good in read speed but lousy in write speed, and then I have flash drives which are very poor in read speed but excellent in write speed. And of course, then the third option is I have excellent read and write. And when it comes to a few that I have, the read and write is so slow that I just put them aside. And what I use those for is that when someone says, you know, that document you wrote, can you just put it on a USB flash drive for me? Hey, you know, it's like someone borrowing a cup of sugar. You don't expect to see a cup of sugar to come back to you. So that's what I use it for. But I do have a use for fast read and slow write. And that's when I put a lot of the application programs that I transfer to a USB flash drive for installation. You're not going to write on it. You just use the USB flash drive to install the program. And what if you do have a good write but a poor read? I use those for backup, backing up certain types of machines, or when I'm asked to help. And of course, I always say, did you back up yet before I even, you know, change anything on it? I hate to tell you, 9 times out of 10, they said, what do you mean by backup? So that's what I use it for. So now we have micro SD cards and SD cards, and they're widely used, especially micro SD cards, with smartphones. And I find that a lot of the low-end PCs now that sells for less than $200, you get like 32 gig of memory, and then there's a micro SD slot or SD slot. Well, what I have done, at least I with a low-cost Dell laptop I have that cost me brand new, was it $99 it cost me on Black Friday? What I do is that I put a 64 gig micro SD card in there, and so that's where I move part of the operating system. Well, SanDisk made an announcement, and it's available, and I got excited over it. They are now making two things available. One is they have a new product. It's not an SD, it's a micro SD. And now they are selling a micro SD chip with 400 gigabyte of capacity. Wow, that's great. And the other thing that is interesting about it is that there's a designation on it called A1. Well, what it is that a new standard has been established called App Performance Class, or Application Performance Class. And on this chip, there's an A1 on it. And the A1 basically is, it's a, you know, read-write speeds, and it's expressed slightly differently. And what I find interesting is that it's oddly faster. Like, for instance, The App Performance Class A1 memory cards, they have three categories. It's called Read IOPS, which is Instruction of Operations Per Second, and WR, which is Write IOPS, which is the number of writes you can do, instructions per second, and sequentially the speed. And so you have RD IOPS, WR IOPS, and sequential. And the A1 class, now I don't know what the A2 class is, I'm going to have to look it up, but with class one, it has to be at minimum 1,500 instruction operations per second. That's fast for a read. On a write, it must be at least a minimum of 500 input-output instructions per second. And then sequential, it's 10 mega, I don't know what it's, it looks like 10 megabytes per second. So that's good speed. That's like a magnitude or greater. And on the class one, the only thing that SanDisk would tell you about it is that it's fast. You can use it for just about anything. The only thing that they don't recommend it for is if you happen to have, let's say, you want to watch a video and it's 4K. Well, 4K, they say, you're going to get a lot of the buffering and so on. But you know what? This is great. Great to have. So for those who are now buying micro SD and SD cards, there's a new classification called AP1. Or App Performance Class, look for it. It's worth it because there's no sense buying the slower ones. However, you got to be careful, though, because the hardware itself. Now, I happen to have one of the, they have the SD, SD, HC, SD, XC, and so on. I had an SD, XC, a micro SD chip, and I put it into a very old machine, and it only recognized it did not recognize the full capacity of the card because the memory addressing on it did not go to SDXC, and all I got was SD, a regular SD addressing on it. So if you do buy one of these high-capacity cards, just remember that if you use it, you're going to get a lower capacity rating. Nothing wrong with the card. You don't have to yell and say, you cheated me, where is it? But even if you can't use it, buy the high capacity. So when you do buy the, some new equipment, you could start using it. So that was the new hardware revelation for this past week. Now, one of the things that I did want to talk about, I want to spend a little time on, is the question is, who invented email? And the reason why I asked that question is who invented email was I got a piece of email from a company, and they had deemed that from August 30th to September 30th, they have designated that as Email Appreciation Month. Oh, okay. Father's Day, Mother's Day, Grandfather's Day, and so on. And okay, so it's Email Appreciation Month, so I said, okay, let me. But the narrative that came with it is that they were celebrating 35 years ago on August the 30th, 1982, a young high school student by the name of Shiva, and I hope I apologize if I mispronounce his last name, is Ayadore, claimed to have received the first U.S. copyright for email, a computer program for electronic mail system, and that he was recognized as the inventor of email. And I'm saying to myself, wait a minute, 1982? Okay. Well, before I comment on that, basically what he's saying is that because he had sent in a copyright registration and because it was accepted by the Copyright Office, it was considered to be an acceptance by the government that he invented email. Well, let me make a comment on that. Copyright protects expression, and patents protects inventions, and neither protects ideas. In both cases, the idea is the first critical step, but without some identifiable embodiment of the idea, There can be no intellectual property protection obtained and no exclusive rights will flow onto you. In other words, if I had a piece of paper, I write some code on it, and so long as I didn't plagiarize anyone, I could just send it in for a copyright registration. It doesn't matter what's on it. The copyright office don't care what that content is. I could say that I invented the airplane as part of the narrative, and just because they accept it does not mean that I invented the airplane. Well, and the reason why I thought about this was that, well, he was 14 years old then in the late 1970s, and this was registered in 1982. Gee, I remember using email back in the 60s. I remember there was Deck Mail, there was Wang Mail, there was G-Coast Mail. And I'm saying, who really invented the email? Well, in terms of most journals that I've gone through, Raymond Samuel Ray Tomlinson, he worked for ARPANET, implemented the first email program back in 1971 and was the first system able to send mail between users on different hosts connected to the ARPANET. And so there's a controversy over that. And rather than get into he said, she said, who did what and so on, let me just say that from my perspective, and I speak only for myself, calling it that he invented email, well, he can call it what he wants, okay? Now, the company that I got the information from that had designated April 30th to September 30th as Email Appreciation Month, the name of the company is Innovation Corp. And it's if you go on the internet, it says innovationcorp.org. Okay, so I just said, you know what? I couldn't find any other organization, saying this is Email Appreciation Month, but there's nothing wrong with saying that. So I did a lookup on Innovation Corp. It was founded by Shiva Ayyadure. In other words, the one who claims he invented email. So you use your own judgment on who really invented email. But one of the things that you're going to find is that just because you find it on the internet, it could be correct, it could be misstated, it could be overstated, it could be an outright, false. You gotta do some vetting on it. And the reason why I say that is because I became aware of this email thing because I was watching one of the cable companies that referred to, wow, this is Email Appreciation Month. And most people, when they get a press release, they read it, and if it's there's a angle to it, like, oh, a 14-year-old kid, he has this, he invented email, and that can go viral. I wouldn't be surprised if it did go viral, but you got to do some homework on it. So I just want to alert everyone to that. The other item that I do want to talk about that occurred this past week, and it's really quite important, is the U.S. government, what they have is that they have a ex-cop. His name is Francis Rawls, R-A-W-L-S, and he's in jail. And the government claims that, by the way, he's been in jail for 2 years now. And the reason why is because the government has asked him to decrypt, on his computer, to do the decryption. In other words, you don't have to give me the code. That's what the government's saying. But just decrypt your hard drives. He had two hard drives in question. And what he said was, and I don't know whether it's true or not, what he says is he can't remember what the encryption code was. So therefore, he sits there in prison and... I don't know. This is a weird one because if I were him, what I would say is, try these. I've used these codes, and why don't you try it? I don't know whether he did or not. But he's in prison for child abuse. And what interested me was what his lawyer had to say. And the lawyer is saying, listen, he's been, you know, they pointed out that his stay in prison has already exceeded the maximum 18-month sentence under the an 1826 statute. But the government points out that he is not being held under that statute, but he's being held under the All Writs Act, which was, you probably heard of that. That was applied to Apple. And basically, the government says this, you know, I think this goes back to 1812 or something like that. And if we ask you to do something, you got to do it. And now his lawyer is saying is he's pleading the Fifth Amendment, saying that he has a right to not incriminate himself if there's anything on it that may incriminate him. So I don't know where this is going to go. On the one hand, to hold someone in jail because the government says you have to decrypt that information so we can see it. The government has not established what that information is. I think if the government would say we are certain that there's information on it that we need. Now, in the case of Apple, it's very similar. In the case of Apple, with a terrorist, they say there may be information on it that can affect how we handle maybe associate terrorists, an organization, or associate terrorists themselves. But I don't know. This is something. I don't know where they're going to go on this. But hopefully, when the Patriot Act is, which is, I think, expires the end of the year, they can come up with something that is a lot cleaner, more definitive. And I've already said to a number of people, you know, when it comes to terrorism, the terrorists won. And I've been told, what do you mean they won? We're still fighting them. No, they won. Well, why do I say they won? I had to I had some business to do, and I've been to the airport a couple of times in the past couple of months. You see people taking off their shoes, emptying out their pockets. You know what? They won. That inconvenience, that long delay that causes an extraordinary amount of processing, all the TSA people that had to be hired, they won. And I don't know, maybe that's the price of freedom. I have to tell you, one of the problems I have with TSA and I've learned is that when you go to the airport, if you disagree with them, do not argue with them. Don't. If you argue with them, they'll pull you out of line, you'll miss your flight, or they'll give you a hard time. What happened to me? Well, I won't identify the airline because I think it's more of the question of the person, you know, the personnel itself, and I don't want to, cause any problem with an airline because I'm sure that, you know, by the way, in terms of what TSA does in terms of security, I believe it's only one set of rules. But I've been on, three different airlines in the past 2 months, and they all seem to have different set of rules. I'll give you an example, okay? I went to the airport, and I had my boarding pass in my hand, and the TSA person says, you got to put that in the bin. I said, it's only a piece of paper. Put it in the bin. So as I put it into the bin, what I did was I also started taking my watch off, which is metal. Oh, no, leave your watch on. Now, I'm scratching my head. You asked me to put my boarding pass into a bin, and I hope I don't lose that boarding pass as it goes through the machine because there's so much stuff jammed through, and you just have to wait there and people grabbing their stuff. But when it comes to the watch, to leave it on, it makes no sense to me. I've also been on where at one of the airports where I started to, you know, put things away. Oh, no, just go right through. The only thing I know for sure that they all adhered to was, oh, you don't have to take off your shoes if you're more than 75 years of age. Boy, that's the only thing? Well, we'll see about that. But we have a number of interesting things. And, one other thing I did want to talk about is that there's a class action lawsuit. And I say that's somewhat sort of like, you know, a class action lawsuit means you got to identify who the other people are, in, you know, to join you in the lawsuit. But this couple is suing Amazon because they bought some solar eclipse viewing goggles they were faulty, and they claimed that they didn't feel well. You know, they got a headache from it. I don't know. I don't know where this is going to go to. Is it Amazon or is it the product? Does Amazon have liability? I'm not a lawyer. Gee, can you imagine if I were a lawyer, what some of the things I could bring up? This evening, in the second half of the show, I do have a couple of things that we will be covering. And, let me get to it right now. Alfred Poor is going to cover in wearable and health technology. And he's got three segments on there. And, one of the things that he's going to cover that really interested me is a robotic arm and hand that, you know, when you talk about robotics, things can go wrong with robotics, and then you got to pull it out and fix it. Wow, can you imagine if you had a robot that can fix itself? And the way they call it is a robotic arm that can heal itself. That's fascinating. That's interesting. And the other thing is that with home automation, I had a long talk with Marty Winston on that. And I'm thinking about, you know, alternate source of power. How do you make sure you always have power? You need power and so on. And I was talking about solar panels, and I learned quite a bit from him on it, and he's going to be talking about it. But with solar panels, there's what is called a degradation factor. Now, I know what a degradation factor is because when you buy a laptop, there is a degradation or what they call a wear factor on a laptop. And anything that exceeds 20%, in other words, if there's a 1% degradation, that means that it's 99% efficient. If there's a 20% degradation, that means it's 80% efficient. And one of the rules of thumbs that many people use is that once the efficiency is below 80%, go get a new battery. Now, that may sound simple, but as anyone knows, there is no standard battery size. It seems like every machine from the same manufacturer, they have so many different sizes. You know, it could be an inch shorter here, a little more here and there. And when you're ready to buy it, you just hope that the manufacturer is still selling it. And when they do sell it, they're not cheap at all. But if you go to a third-party vendor, and as I found out, is that they come over from China. There's no way you can sue them. There's no way you can even try to get your money back. What happens is that the capacitance rating on it is ginned up. It's phony. So you just learn to live with it. Now, in the case of a solar panel, you got so many solar panel manufacturers, and the rate of degradation on solar panels ranges anywhere from 1% a year to more than that. Well, we're going to talk about that, and I did some work on it, and I was surprised that the range of degradation in 1 year could be 1%, which is very tolerable. That means that in 20 years' time, you got to replace it, but that's okay if it can last 20 years. But some of the solar panels, the degradation the first year is 35%. Wow. That means that, hey, in less than a year, you got to replace it. Well, hopefully you'll be able to go back to the manufacturer and say, hey, I need a replacement. So if you're talking about solar panel installations, do your homework and don't be afraid to spend a little more. Get a quality product. And you'll be interested in hearing what I found out. And Marty adds to it. And hey, you know what? Let's get to it right now. For the second half of the show, we have two exciting feature segments. We have from Dr. Alfred Poor, wearable and health technology, and he's going to be talking about lower body exoskeleton. I'm looking forward to hearing that because I walk very slowly now, and perhaps the exoskeleton will be useful for me. He will also be talking about wearable lab tests. And finally, he will also cover something relatively new, which is robotic arm and hand that can heal itself. Marty Winston on home automation, I had asked him about using power sources off the grid. And he's not for solar panels for off the grid because of the product life cycle. His goal is a 40-year house without maintenance. And solar panels, they range in product life cycle anywhere from 15, 20 years, and it does require maintenance. So let's get to it.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. Exoskeletons are really cool science. It's a way of extending our body's abilities. It can make us stronger, faster, and all those things, but it also can help replace facilities that people have lost through injury or birth defects or whatever. So an exoskeleton can actually augment the individual's abilities. I've covered a lot of different exoskeleton technologies over the years, but there's an interesting new development from a company called Bionic Labs. It's basically a lower body exoskeleton. The idea is that the upper body movements can help initiate movement, like walking and so forth. But the added wrinkle in this case is that they're building in an Alexa voice assistant technology, the same Alexa that's in the Amazon Alexa device that you can have sitting on your desktop. And the point of this is that you can then give a voice command to the exoskeleton and it will execute a higher level instruction. So rather than think about it or have to tell it to, you know, lift the left leg and put it down and then lift the right leg and move it forward and put it down and so forth, you can say, Alexa, let's walk forward, or let Alexa go to the door. It is going to open up a whole new kind of power and freedom for people who've lost or never had the mobility that most of us enjoy. The goal is to make this a low-cost device that can be affordable for lots of people. This is just one example of how we're seeing technology compensate for impairments that people may have. If you're like most people, you've been to the hospital or the clinic and had to have some sort of blood test or other chemical test to check the levels of different chemicals in your body, different biomarkers and stuff. If you're like most people, you had to sit there and wait a long time, then they draw your blood or whatever other fluid they want to sample, and then the lab takes it and you go home and you wait 2 or 3 days or more waiting to hear what the results are. Researchers at Purdue University have been looking for a way to help make lab tests faster and more affordable, primarily for underdeveloped regions where they don't have access to sophisticated equipment or clean water or even electricity. They've actually come up with a lab on a slip of paper. You can actually print the materials needed to do these tests right on the paper. And the cool thing about it is that it has an energy harvesting feature built in. There's a layer that converts motion into electricity. So you just tap it or rub it a couple times, and then it's charged up enough to do your test. And so you can drop a tiny drop of blood on one test area, or you can dip the corner into a fluid. Then the results can be read right on the surface in these little squares that change color. And in fact, you can take a picture of the whole test strip using a smartphone, and then it can automatically identify the levels of the different biomarkers that you're interested in and tell you immediately, just in minutes, what the test results are. And since you can take the photo of it, you can also forward that on to health tech professionals, and they can then look at the results and also give you advice. So this means that for the underdeveloped regions, they can do sophisticated lab tests. They've already tested for glucose, uric acid, lactate, ketones, and even white blood cells. This means that you can provide these low-cost, small, easy-to-use devices that don't require any electricity or water or any sophisticated training, and send them out into the field in underdeveloped regions, and they can do sophisticated lab tests right on the spot. But of course, the same benefits will apply in developed regions. So we may find that when you go to the doctor's office, they'll apply the test fluids right on a little strip of paper right in front of you or while you wait, and you'll have your results back in minutes instead of days and at a much lower cost. The researchers are planning to create future versions that could help diagnose things like dengue fever or malaria, yellow fever, hepatitis, or even HIV. This is a new approach that could have a great deal of benefit for millions around the world. Robots are great. They can help people by doing things for us, doing repetitive jobs over and over again. And the same robotic technology that can create robots that work on their own can also be used to create smart prosthetic devices. So creating an arm or a hand that can grab things and manipulate things just through inputs from the wearer, either from their existing muscles or in some cases, hopefully even just by thinking about it, they'll be able to control the device. One of the problems is that when robots get damaged, they need somebody to fix them. This is a disadvantage over a living creature like a human being that can heal itself. Some researchers in Brussels have been working on this problem, and they've actually come up with a possible solution. What they've created is an actuator for soft robotics. Instead of having rigid gears and levers and wheels and so forth, it's made up of soft, inflatable plastic. By changing the air pressure, you can change the motion of the different components. So, for example, you could increase air pressure and cause the fingers of an artificial hand to pull together and grip something. By applying more or less pressure, you can adjust the strength of the grip. What these researchers have come up with is they found a plastic that they can use, sort of a rubber-like plastic, and it has the extraordinary feature that it can heal itself. If you take a knife and cut a slit in it so that the air leaks out and it doesn't work anymore, if you just leave it alone, it will heal itself. I mean, within hours, the cut will seal, and within a day, it will have repaired itself to the point where it's just about impossible to see where the original cut was. This technology could make robotics and prosthetic devices much more durable, much more useful, and require much less maintenance as people use them. So it could make a whole lot of new intelligent devices much more reliable and useful for us all. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Are you thinking of installing solar panels as an alternative source for electrical power? Solar panels don't last forever. They do degrade in performance. What is the rate of degradation? Solar panel degradation varies wildly. Solar panel replacement may not be readily available from the original manufacturer if they are no longer in business. With solar panels, the degradation level for efficiency is up to 20%. With some firms, they quote a product life cycle of 20 years with an annual degradation of 1% per year. There are other manufacturers quoting a more optimistic product life cycle of 30 years with an annual degradation rate of 0.7 of 1% each year. A recent study by an international certification body found that how well solar panels stand up to wear and tear varies greatly, but where their manufacture has little to do with quality. The report was published by Norway-based DNVGL, and what they have found was that from 55 to 60% of the top-performing modules were manufactured in China. According to the study, this demonstrates that manufacturing location is not a factor for reliability. However, the 19 companies that participated in the test with efficiency degradation rates varying from 1% to 35%. That's a very wide margin. The current standard 25-year warranty is typically triggered if modules degrade more than 3% within the first year and at linear rate down to 80% of its original power rating in year 25. Typically, a greater than 20% decline in efficiency is a failure, according to the U.S. National Renewable Energy Laboratory. But there is no consensus on the definition of what is failure. Because a high-efficiency module degrades by 50% may still have a higher efficiency than a non-degraded module from a less efficient technology. Two-thirds of the world's solar capacity was installed within the past 5 years. Accordingly, life expectancy is of upwards of 30 years. However, even if the panels are guaranteed by the manufacturer to last that long, what about the rest of the components that make up the system? There are batteries. Battery use in solar arrays come with a wide range of warranties. Deep cycle lead acid batteries are on the low end of the spectrum, with some manufacturers offering a 1-year limited warranty. Lithium ion, on the other hand, and redox flow battery Manufacturers offer longer warranties. Inverter warranties vary with the different types of inverters. Centro inverters typically come with 5-year limited warranties. String inverters promise a longer lifespan with warranties of about 10 years, and micro inverters come with by far the longest warranty, as much as 25 years. Then there is mounting. Solar mounting warranties also vary from 5 to 25 years, likely because of the range of materials used to make them and other differentiating factors, such as whether it's tracking on a roof or ground-mounted. Because of all the variables, pinning down the lifetime in general is difficult. And then there is also appropriate maintenance that is applied to the product itself. There are 4 types of maintenance that can be offered, according to the National Renewable Energy Lab. There's administrative maintenance, establishing budgets and securing funds for preventive maintenance, corresponding with the customer's record-keeping, reporting on system performance. Preventive maintenance, scheduling maintenance checks to conform to manufacturer's recommendations. Corrective maintenance, well, that's required to repair damage or replace failed component parts. Condition-based maintenance, using real-time information from data loggers to schedule preventive measures like cleaning and anticipating failures or catching them early. Although component warranties may be less than 30 years, if you do your homework before the installation and perform maintenance throughout its lifespan, you can ensure a long life for your solar array.
Hank and I were talking offline about our 40-year maintenance-free, energy-miserly cybernetic house. 40yearhouse.com, which I do still need to catch up on, has more information about that. And, you know, with the design intended to be energy-miserly, we often get people guessing that means we're going off the grid or asking why we aren't simply using alternative energy to go off the grid. And Hank's question was pretty much that. Why aren't we going off the grid? And there are some reasons for that, and I'm going to give you some math. But first, I want to explain a couple of things about going off the grid that isn't as smooth a ride as it seems. First, we haven't found solar panels or batteries for them that can go longer than 5 to 7 years without replacement. And that goes against the concept of being 40 years maintenance-free, the value premise of that. Is it a big deal? Yes, they're not cheap. How much have you saved in the time being? I'll give you some solid numbers for that. But unless you've got some weird kind of underwriting on them, and read those contracts carefully, I don't think you're going to break even on it. I don't think it's going to be anything other than costing you more than utilities, but your mileage may vary. Then, speaking of utilities, there's the whole issue of whether utilities will buy back or even accept customer-generated power. You know, they may or may not do it now, but there's no long-term assurance of that happening into the future. For our project, our builder, now we're in South Carolina, the central Savannah River area. The city is Aiken. The house is just north of Aiken. And it's about 15 miles this side being east of Augusta, Georgia, with the Savannah River between us. Our builder here, Don Serra, is the greenest builder in this part of the nation. He's really brilliant at stuff. And he's estimated that a house that is roughly the same size of ours, built here, would have monthly energy bills, pay attention to this, of $400 to $500. Well, a house with our design for being energy miserly should have energy bills of only $150 to $210 a month. You hear that difference? $400 to $500 versus $150 to $210. That's a difference of $190 to $350 each and every month. It's an average, but that's what it comes down to. You want to deal with the year? Typical house, $4,800 to $6,000 monthly energy bills for all 12 months. The house we're building, $1,800 to $2,520. That's $2,280 to $4,200 less. You got that? How much do you think you're going to save by going off the grid? If you go off the grid, the most you can save against a traditional house is that full $400 to $500. But the most you can save over our house, the way we're building it, is only the $150 to $210. What's it going to cost you to get that in there? What's it going to cost you to maintain it? Where's the break even? And with all the replacement costs that that is going to mean in the future, does break even ever happen, or is it a continuing investment in an indulgence? I don't want to sound like I'm against alternative energy. I think alternative energy is a great idea. I think, you know, if you find an economical way to put up a wind turbine to deal with photovoltaic, if there's a way that solar photovoltaic can make sense, to deal with solar thermal, which I think in many climates is a smarter, ultimately smarter way to deal with alternative energy, or anything you come up with. I don't care if you're capturing photons from fireflies. Whatever you're doing, if you can make it work, if it's making you more than it's costing you, if it's reducing your energy consumption without compromising your comfort, more power to you. But let's talk about the solution that we're pursuing, which is not to go off the grid. It's just to avoid using anywhere near as much of it. Again, you know, $400 to $500, average $450, versus $150 to $210, average $180, $450 to $180. Which bill would you rather pay every month? $450 to $180. Wouldn't that savings be really cool? And the savings are not because we're sacrificing things. We're not living in igloos or in saunas. We're living in a very, very comfortable house. Our measures for making that happen, and these are on the website, 40yearhouse.com. Right now, you can go read them, and there are alternatives to these, have to do more with stopping loss than anything else. You stop loss through better insulation. You stop loss through more efficient ways of delivering things, and you stop loss through some little tricks. For example, the energy that goes to heating hot water, well, our water source is a well pump, and that well pump takes a split when it comes into the house, and the part that's there for hot water before it goes anywhere else goes to a 200-gallon tank in our attic. Now, our attic is conditioned space, which means that the insulation up there is not on the floor of the attic, it's on the ceiling, and we've got an air gap-separated metal roof above with foil underneath. So the attic is conditioned space. We bring that water out of the well up into the attic, comes out of the ground in the mid-50s Fahrenheit, in the mid-50s, sits in the attic in that tank and comes to essentially room temperature, maybe a little bit warmer, but essentially room temperature, mid-70s. We just got a 20-degree boost in the temperature of the water for free. And at the same time, we helped cool the attic in a usually warm climate. Double-double, awfully cool. Now, the hot water leaves there. Where does it go? Well, it has one more pass-by before it gets to the water heater, and that's a heat exchanger. I don't want you to think about the water mixing. It doesn't. Heat exchangers happen when something makes something else a different temperature, and that thermally conducts to yet another something else that passes the change in temperature on. In this case, it takes the hot water coming down the master bath shower drain, uses that to heat metal, uses that metal to heat a pass-through pipe. So anytime our hot water use is because we're taking a shower in the master bath, the most frequent use of hot water, the water going down the drain helps preheat the water going to water heater just a little bit more. And that water heater isn't just tankless. We don't have 40, 50, 60 gallons that we're trying to maintain at temperature 24/7, which is a huge energy burn. We have a tankless hot water heater, which means as soon as there's demand downstream, it turns on the gas to heat the water to send it down. But it's one step above that. It's a condensing tankless hot water heater. I won't explain today why it's condensing. It's an appropriate term, but a little bit obtuse. What I will explain is one more pass. As that water is coming into the hot water heater to be heated, it passes around the flue. So waste heat in the exhaust gas helps, again, preheat the water before it gets to the water heater. Hot water isn't everything. If you take a look at HVAC systems, this is just physics and a little bit of economics. If you are not simply on and off, if you can be variable, if you can be more analog in that approach, if you have a compressor that is something like a scroll compressor, which gives you not just on and off, but continuous variability, if you have a variable speed fan, you've saved a lot of energy in those two things alone because you're never overheating, then waiting for it to cool so the thermostat hysteresis kicks in and you turn it on again. You're never doing that. You're just hitting what you need when you need it. There's one more piece. Every HVAC, really every heat pump kind of system, has a measure of dealing with what happens if it gets too cold for the heat pump to remain effective. Now, a heat pump is effective at almost every temperature, but its effectiveness rate starts falling off, essentially in the high 20s. It gets down below freezing, and it can't quite make it comfortable all on its own. So there's always some kind of little booster heater. And in most HVAC systems, it is essentially a hot wire electric heater. And it's in a blow chamber, and the fan blows that around to help heat the house. But in ours, back to that hot water heater, it's hydronic. We have a hot water exchange happening up there in really cold weather, and it does a great job of providing warm air to boost what the heat pump action is doing. And, of course, we have to make sure the control systems stay reliable. So what do, Hank? Yeah, you got it. We back up, back up, back up. Now back to you.
Thank you, Marty.
Public service announcements. The Westchester PC Users Group will be meeting on Thursday, September the 7th, which is tomorrow, and the presentation is The Power of Networking. Meeting time is 7 p.m. They will meet at the Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road, room 101 in White Plains, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group has scheduled Friday, this Friday, September the 8th, to meet at 7 p.m. at the New York Institute of Technology at the Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, and they'll meet in the auditorium of the Harry J. Scherer Hall. Rockland PC Users Group, they'll have their meeting next week, Tuesday, September the 12th. Meeting time starts at 7:15 p.m., Rassel Room on the fourth floor at the Palisades Moor in West Nyack. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on Rules of Thumb for Computer Security next Thursday, September the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, room 401, 31 Washington Place in Manhattan, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have a presentation on AT&T Digital Life Home Automation, Friday, September the 15th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916, that's 1916 Bartow Avenue, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, September the 26th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Mercer County Library, Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group will be meeting on September the 28th. That's on a Thursday. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. And the presentation is Teaching People How to Use Modern Computing Devices. They'll meet at the Middletown Library in the large meeting room at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. And these meetings are all open to the public. They are free, and we hope to see you there. The website for the Personal Computer Show is www.pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at PC Radio 212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, and also on WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe, keep cool, and until we meet again, same time, same station next week.